Upper West Side, the 8th Avenue line. Daniel would walk home.
Look,
he said and fell silent. Gabriella turned to him. She stepped aside so that the beam from a streetlight was not in her eyes.
Look,
she prompted. Daniel spoke like a patient saved by an emergency room surgeon.
I really owe you. For the Princeton solution.
It would have worked out, she said gravely.
Not the way you handled it.
Did the best I could under, let's say, difficult circumstances. But the expression of gratitude was, of course, a prelude to the inevitable. He said,
Okay, I find you very attractive, but that's only part of it. I like you. You're fun, you're artsy, you know business. So here's the thing. I'm not seeing anybody, and I haven't been seeing anybody for a while. Can I call you?
Anybody can call anybody if they have the number, Gabriella said. The question is, will I pick up? Daniel looked pensive.
Remember the days before caller ID? That was life on the edge, wasn't it? Do I pick up or not?
She filled in. Would it be a telemarketer, date, ex-boyfriend, a job offer?
Or a wrong number?
Or God forbid your mother. Gabriella winced. We're soft nowadays.
Cowards.
They stood 3 feet from each other. Businessmen scooted around them, cars shushed past. It was time to part ways. They both knew it. He leaned in for a cheek brush. She felt heat. She felt a faint stubble. The residue of moisture from earlier, recalling his wiping it from their brows and cheeks.
Night.
His word was spoken softly. Night. She turned and started down the stairs, digging for her metro pass. Then stopped. She called,
My shoes?
What?
That old Tiffany bag I had, with my grown-up shoes inside?
Earlier that evening, she'd swapped her high heels for the Aldo flats she now wore.
I left it at the restaurant.
He grinned.
No,
she said, stifling a laugh. Not on purpose.
You sure? Maybe for another chance to see me again?
Gabriella said, Sorry. I wouldn't risk losing a pair of Stuart Weitzmans just to see a man again. Any man. Daniel said,
How's this? We can avoid the phone call issue altogether. We'll commit now. I'll stop at the restaurant on the way to my home, pick them up, and deliver them tomorrow at breakfast. How's Irving's Deli, Broadway?
9? She paused, then said, I suppose.
I know,
he said, his face growing grave.
You're thinking, will breakfast be as dull as tonight?
Nothing could be as boring as the past 3 hours, Gabriella replied, and disappeared down the subway entrance. Chapter 6. 6:30 p.m. Friday. 3 hours, 30 minutes earlier. The Aqua Riva Super cut an uncompromising swath through the dusk of New York Harbor. Daniel Reardon at the helm.
How fast are we going?
Gabriella called over the sexy rumble of the engine, the wind, the waves.
About 40.
Knots per hour?
Daniel shouted.
You don't say that. Knots include miles and hours. 40 knots. It's about 45 miles an hour.
Gabriella nodded, smiling at the speed.
Feels faster.
Then you'd like the boat I keep in Connecticut. It'll do 70.
She didn't bother to ask knots or miles. Probably didn't matter at that velocity. There was no passenger seat in the front of the beautiful Italian speedboat as such, just a leather U-shaped banquette encircling the rear of the open cockpit. Gabriella could have squeezed in next to Daniel on the driver's seat, but she preferred to remain standing behind him, close, gripping his seat back, her head near his ear. The 33-footer, with her black hull and rich wood deck, plowed effortlessly through the temperate waves. The surface of the water was like dark linen, and the cloudless sky over New Jersey glowed lava orange from the vanishing sun, the vista split by 2 purple exclamation marks of fume from distant smokestacks. It was a photograph waiting to happen, though not to be shot by Gabriella. She worked exclusively in black and white, and this scene was about color only, without substance. Pretty didn't interest her. She turned her attention back to Daniel. He was a superb driver, which is what pilots of boats like this were called, she'd learned. He anticipated the drift and power of each wave as if it were an opposing player on a sports field. Sometimes he crashed over it. Sometimes he eased up onto a crest and used the mound of water itself to speed the boat forward. She found his handling of the wheel and chrome controls intensely sensual, and felt that low unfurling within her as she noted his firm grip, half-smile, utter concentration. The blue eyes were focused on the water, the way a lion sights for prey. Gabriella leaned closer yet and smelled past his aftershave to his hair and scalp and skin.
"What do you think?" he asked. "I've been on rowboats in Central Park," Gabriella told him. "I'm not qualified to judge performance."
The words might have been taken as flirt. He gave no response. She wondered how she felt about that. She continued in a shout.
"But on the surface, so to speak," he laughed. "Incredible."
Daniel throttled back and for a time they cruised. They could speak without raising voices now. He said with a grim expression,
"Well, hate to ruin the mood, but I don't have much time left. I really need your help."
A reminder of the conundrum he'd mentioned earlier. He nodded at a thick binder sitting on the floor of the boat between them. She said firmly, "You have to go with the Princeton formula."
"Princeton?"
He frowned. "Look on page 38. That's the answer." He balanced the binder on his lap and flipped through pages. At once, he stopped and stared down.
"You're sure? Princeton?"
"Absolutely no doubt."
"That's pretty risky, don't you think?"
"Which is why I suggested it." He seemed uncertain. Gabriella said, "But it's your decision."
"No. No."
Daniel looked around him.
"Okay, I'll go with it."
He laughed.
"The Princeton solution,"
he added.
"You're a lifesaver."
She blinked at the word.
"Could you pick another figure of speech?
I mean, considering we're in the middle of New York Harbor and happen to be sailing toward that really big ship." He looked up.
"It's a mile away. That reminds me, I forgot to ask, can you swim?"
"How bad a sailor are you?" she asked.
"I just mean I'll give you a PPD.
PP what?
Personal protection device. Or, your word, lifesaver."
"I can swim," she said.
"Hold on."
When he noted her firm grip on the handholds, he steered into an impressive wake, took it head on. The boat nearly caught air and slammed into the water on the other side of the crest. Spray dashed onto their faces.
"Come here."
Daniel reached into his breast pocket and withdrew a white silk handkerchief.
"Decorative only,"
he said, smiling. She leaned forward and he wiped the salt spray from her forehead and cheeks, then his own. He now steered parallel to Manhattan. They took in the otherworldly sight of the lights of the city coming alive and growing brighter. In the deepening dusk, Gabriella was cold. She shivered and pulled her black and white jacket around her more tightly. Daniel consulted his watch. 7:40.
"You still up for dinner?"
"Oh, by the way, I don't get seasick." He frowned.
"Should have asked too. Oops."
"I would have told you. I just mean, in answer to your question, yes, I'm starving. And we should get back soon. On the nights I don't have Sarah, I call her before she goes to bed. I never miss it."
"I try to do the same with the boys."
He turned south down the Hudson and back into the harbor proper. Daniel eased the throttle forward. He had a devilish smile.
15 minutes more?"
"Sure." He steered to the right, closer to the container ship she'd seen earlier, which was steaming at a good clip toward the Verrazano Narrows.
"God, it's huge."
"That one's a post-Panamax. Means she won't fit through the Panama Canal."
"How high is it?"
She was staring up as they approached the massive hull, red and scabby, laden with containers of all colors.
"I don't know,"
Daniel replied.
10 stories, maybe, probably more. They're classified by length and breadth, not height. She's probably 1,000 feet long, 120 wide.
She? Are all boats girls?
No, they're women.
Without a millisecond of hesitation. Got me there, she thought, and had to laugh.
It's magnificent and it's ugly,
Gabriella called.
She is, I mean.
Then she tapped the dashboard.
Your boat? What's her name? I didn't look at the back.
Boat.
The wind gusted. She shouted,
Right, what's her name?
No, boat's her name.
That's all you could come up with?
It's all I wanted.
And boat wasn't taken?
It's not like you have to trademark names. But no, I've never seen boat. Most people are more creative.
He described and spelled some.
Irritable bow. A crude interest. Charlie's tuition. Naughty call.
She groaned.
Hold on. Here comes the monster's wake.
Impressive crests of water charged them. She knelt, gripped more tightly yet, the backs of her hands pressed against his shoulders. It seemed that he settled back firmly against her knuckles. Daniel straightened the craft and expertly tricked the engine and wheel as they met the first wave. Boat crashed into and over the swell. Gabriella felt her breath leave her lungs as they landed hard. Another 12 collisions, each tamer than the one before. The boat settled into a gentle rocking.
Look,
he said with admiration bordering on awe in his voice. If the Chinese sea monster was impressive, the ship they saw to their right was breathtaking.
It's as big as a city, she called. What's that one?
A VLCC. Very large crude carrier. A tanker. And see how high she's riding? She's in ballast, no oil on board. She offloaded in Jersey.
Going to the Panama Canal?
She's not going to fit either. She's headed to the Mediterranean or all the way around the Horn.
Titanic!
He laughed.
Titanic was half her size.
Nodding at the supertanker.
How fast is she going?
Even full, they can do 18 knots. Empty? 25, I'd guess. If I was alone, I'd race her to that buoy.
Why?
Daniel shrugged.
Because it'd be fun.
No, I mean, why only if you were alone?
When he hesitated, she added, Go ahead, do it.
Race?
Sure.
I don't know.
She whispered, You have me to thank for the Princeton solution, remember? You owe me. Daniel steered toward the buoy and throttled back, as if giving the VLCC, which must have outweighed boat by 100,000 tons, a head start. The speedboat's exhaust bubbled, the wind hissed, and behind them gulls shrieked a plea for chum.
Ready?
She cried.
Go!
Daniel rammed the throttles forward, and boat sprang away, her needle-shaped bow lifting high as they sprinted for the buoy. Boat and the massive tanker were on intersecting 45-degree courses. Every second it grew bigger and darker as they wedged toward each other. Soon the VLCC was an otherworldly thing, visible only in outline and running lights and occasional amber dots of windows. An unstoppable shape, absorbing the entire sky, yet still growing, growing.
It'll be close,
Daniel shouted. They both glanced to their right at the crude carrier, then ahead to the buoy, which was 300 yards away.
Then 200.
One.
Close!
Daniel repeated in a ragged shout.
It'll be close! I can stop! You want me to stop?
Her heart pounding, a primitive drum, electrified by the speed, by the looming nearness of the massive vessel, by the presence of the man at the wheel, inches from her. Gabriella leaned closer and put her head against his.
Win,
she whispered.
I want you to win.
Chapter 5. 5 p.m. Friday, 1 hour 30 minutes earlier. Limoncello's was not busy. Perhaps it would be, probably would, since the restaurant was in the heart of Wall Street and it was Friday. And the place overlooked picturesque New York Harbor, offering a view of boats and endless waves, rising and falling like a metronome. This was just the spot for traders and brokers who'd toyed with millions of other people's dollars in the last 8 hours to celebrate their good decisions, to forget the bad. But now, late afternoon, the bar was half empty. Those business folks who'd arrive later were still at their desks or writing up tickets on the floors of the closed exchanges, or at health clubs and on jogs through Battery Park. Here, particularly near the water, you could smell autumn in the air. Gabriella wove through the brass and oak-accented room, returning from the toilet to the tall chair at the bar, which she'd occupied for the past half hour. She slipped her black-and-white checked jacket off, hung it over the back of the stool. A white silk blouse was tucked primly into a knee-length pleated gray skirt. She wore black hose and mottled burgundy and black high heels. She would change into her black flats, her walking-to-work shoes, later. That comfy pair were on the floor, in the faded Tiffany bag she used for footwear transport. She resumed editing the documents she'd been poring over since she'd arrived. The top one was headed Open Items for Accountant. Several entries she crossed through completely. Others she marked with precise asterisks, each line of the sunburst an equal length. Beneath these were a half dozen sheets, headed with the names of companies, and below that, balance sheet and P&L. There wasn't a single sheet that listed assets below $250 million. Another said CP Personal Accounts. She then turned to another contract, headed Short-Term Commercial Lease. But there was nothing brief about the contents. 20 pages of dense type. She sighed and started through it once more, pausing once to note herself in the mirror. Her hair was pulled back severely and pinned, which made the auburn shade lighter for some reason. She edited more, then looked out the tall windows, sipped wine, and caught a glimpse of City Pier A. The structure wasn't as large as other piers farther north in Greenwich Village and in Midtown, but this one had more history. The professor had been particularly interested in the sagas of downtown Manhattan and would spend hours reeling off stories to her. Built in the 1880s for the Department of Docks and the Harbor Police, Pier A had been witness to the relentless expansion of the city. She noted the 7-story clock tower, which had been built in 1919. The elaborate timepiece was a memorial to the U.S. soldiers killed in the First World War. This was particularly poignant, considering that the original pier had been built by the son of a famous Union general in the Civil War. She could listen to the professor for hours. As Gabriella returned to the lease, the man beside her set his drink down and continued to speak into his mobile phone. Gabriella stiffened and blurted, "Oh, hey." When he didn't respond, she spoke more forcefully. "Excuse me." He finally realized that he was the object of the comment. He turned, frowning. She was displaying her sleeve, which was stained brown. "Look." His square, handsome face, eerily resembling that of a well-known actor beneath close-cropped black hair, studied the sleeve and then her face. His eyes followed hers to his glass of scotch. His brows rose.
"Oh, hell."
Into the phone.
"I'll call you back, Andrew."
He disconnected.
"Did I do that? I'm sorry."
Gabriella said, "When you put your glass down, yeah, just now. On the phone, you were talking and you turned. It spilled."
"Sorry," he repeated.
It sounded genuine, not defensive. His eyes migrated from the stain to her white blouse, all of the blouse, beneath which a trace of bra was visible. It was pale blue. Then his gaze settled back on the stain.
"Silk?"
"Yes, it is."
"I know what to do,"
he explained, and took charge, summoning the bartender, a young man who seemed to be covering tats on his neck with makeup. This was a Wall Street, not an East Village bar.
"Soda water and a towel. No, not the green one, the white one. The white towel and salt."
"Salt?"
"Salt."
The remedies arrived. He didn't apply the water and seasoning himself, but let her do it. She'd heard the trick, too, from her mother, as he had from his grandmother, he told her.
"Careful with the salt," he said. "I don't know how well it works on silk. You might hurt the cloth if you rub too hard.
The magic trick did a pretty good job. Just the faintest discoloration remained. She examined him with eyes beneath furrowed brows, then, "Why don't you drink martinis like everybody else here?"
"I don't like martinis. I'd probably have a strawberry Cosmo, and if that was the case, the stain would never come out. I'll pay for the cleaning."
"If I were a man, would you make that offer?"
"I don't make any offers to a man wearing a silk blouse."
She kept a straight face for a moment, then laughed. "No, thanks. It'd have to go to the laundry anyway."
"Well, I apologize again."
She lifted her palms. "Accepted." With detente achieved, she returned to the lease and he to his mobile. But when the last page of the document was marked up and when his call was disconnected, the silence prodded them to glance toward each other, in the mirror at first, and conversation resumed.
"I'm sending you back home, stinking of whiskey. What's your husband going to say?"
"He probably won't find out, since he lives 30 miles away from me."
"Ah, you're in that club too. I'm Daniel Reardon."
"Gabriella McKenzie." They shook hands. Conversation meandered for a bit, both of them testing the waters, and then found true north, which included the question you can never avoid in New York: what do you do for a living? Daniel worked as a venture capitalist, private equity, he told her, the Norwalk Fund. He nodded.
"We're a few blocks from here, on Broad."
Gabriella glanced at the documents. "I'm an office manager for a financial advisor, Prescott Investments."
"Don't think I know them."
He glanced down at the documents before her, then away quickly, as if looking at confidential client details was tantamount to glancing through an inadvertently left open bathroom door. "It's a small outfit. Charles was with Merrill years ago, but opened his own shop. He's a lot happier."
"Your office is near here?"
"No, Midtown East, Turtle Bay." She sighed. "My boss, he's a great guy, but he dumped this in my lap this morning. He wants to lease a warehouse on Bankers Square near Wall Street, and the deal fell through. I got elected to check out some new space and go over a 40-page lease. We need to sign it up in 2 weeks.
2 weeks?
"Yep. And you know Bankers Square. It took hours even to get inside and look the place over. All that construction."
"Oh, the new stock market annex. Supposed to be finished by now."
"Anyway, I came here to jot some notes and unwind."
"And get a drink spilled on you."
"It sounded like you were working too. A business call." She nodded at the two mobiles that sat in front of him. An iPhone and a Motorola Droid.
"I was doing a project with a partnership in Aruba. It just closed today. I've been banging out the details since 9.
"Congratulations, and my sympathies."
"Thanks."
Daniel laughed and sipped the scotch.
"I went for a swim at my health club and came over here to unwind."
She smiled at the echo. The talk veered slowly from the professional. Personal stats were recited. They both lived in Manhattan. He told her that he had 2 sons living with his ex in Nyack. "My husband and I have joint custody." Gabriella tugged her phone from her coach purse. She scrolled and displayed a picture. "This is Sarah. She's 6.
"Adorable."
"She's into ballet and gymnastics, but she just discovered horses. Oh, does she want a horse?"
"Where are you in the city?"
"Upper West. 2 bedrooms, 1,000 square feet. We could probably fit a horse in, but I don't think they do well in elevators."
"And Sarah's dad?"
She said, "No, he's okay in elevators."
"You're pretty funny."
Spoken as if Daniel didn't date women who were. "Tim lives on Long Island," Gabriella continued, "but not in the horse stabling neighborhood." Daniel gestured to the bartender, who responded immediately.
"Another for me, and the same for her."
"No, really," Gabriella protested.
"Cheaper than buying you a new Neiman Marcus blouse."
"It's Macy's. But I didn't mean no to the drink. I meant no to what I'm drinking. I'll upgrade to the Mary Edwards Pinot Noir since he's buying." Daniel lifted an eyebrow, impressed at her choice. A moment later, the drinks appeared. She wondered what tats the bartender was hiding with the makeup. Occupy. Down with the 1%. Or maybe something simple. Screw capitalism. She thought about saying this to Daniel, but while he'd probably laugh, she decided not to. When the new glasses arrived, they tapped and talked about the agony and ecstasy of living in the city. About Ground Zero, which was visible from Limoncello's. The trade towers would forever cast indelible shadows over the city. Then a dozen subjects arose in easy conversation. Restaurants, traveling, parents, politics, the last in a safely glancing fashion, though their views seemed similar. When they were close to finishing their drinks, Daniel looked at his watch. Didn't sneak a glance, just lifted the heavy Rolex and noted the time. She nodded. Dinner plans, sure.
Actually, no. I have a meeting.
Daniel's eyes circled. Her hair, her face, her eyes.
You have to get back to your daughter?
She sniffed subtext. I'll pick her up tomorrow. She's at her father's tonight.
Don't know if you're interested, but that meeting? You have any interest in helping me out?
Doing what?
Actually, I'm meeting an interior designer to pick out upholstery.
She shook her head. That's not a good come online.
I'm having new leather installed in my speedboat.
That's a better one. He opened the backpack he used for a briefcase and took out a booklet of leather samples. She flipped through the pages, which were organized by color. Her favorites were the rich oranges, the sort she imagined as the color of seats in brash sports cars. The names were words like carrot, pumpkin, amber, tomato. But her favorite was called Princeton, presumably after the school colors of the New Jersey University. It was the boldest offered by the company. I do have a preference, Gabriella said slowly. But how can I say for sure without seeing the boat?
We can fix that.
Chapter 4. 1:30 p.m. Friday. 3 hours, 30 minutes earlier. The Prius, tinted in Toyota's wan, innocuous light blue, eased through the winding streets of Bronxville, New York, past mansions nestled in spacious yards of yellowing grass, waning gardens, banks of crisp September leaves. Accustomed to driving his Maserati, Daniel Reardon didn't much care for the car, though he hadn't expected power. It was mostly the quiet of the engine he objected to. He'd heard there were some cars that now added sound, sexy engine noises through speakers. This was a cheat, and he thought it ridiculous. Daniel liked authenticity, for good or bad. The Maserati's tubi exhausts, for instance, resonated at a high pitch that could, in the upper gear ranges, threaten to pierce your eardrums. He loved that. Faint classical music was on the radio, but it dimmed when an incoming call announced itself. Daniel answered and spoke to his client in the awkward language of business that is at the same time vague and precise. Finally, some technical, legal, and financial decisions made, he offered a pleasant farewell to the man who'd earned the Norwalk Fund close to $200,000 last year. He disconnected. The classical music rose once more. Mozart, the clarinet concerto. An odd instrument and very difficult, he knew, to play well. He'd dated a girl once who'd been a clarinetist in a symphony orchestra. She'd explained that the reeds had taken her the most time to master. You've got to negotiate the sound from them. Daniel had liked that expression quite a lot, which was why he remembered the sentence, while the image of the girl had all but vanished years ago. In his gray Canali suit, Daniel was certainly dressed for this area. He seemed like any other businessman returning home early from his White Plains law firm or investment bank. He drove carefully. The streets were slick with colorful layers. Wind and rain had conspired to thin the canopy of oak and maple, decimating the foliage, almost literally, removing about every tenth leaf or so. Daniel grew irritated when people used the verb incorrectly. He steered onto Henderson Lane, presently deserted of traffic, and continued past houses less opulent than the mansions, but just as quiet. The windows of the structures were dark, mostly, and he spotted not a single person on the clean sidewalks. At a four-way intersection, he braked to a stop and let a Grand Cherokee, dark red, precede him, turning into Henderson. Daniel accelerated slowly and fell in behind the vehicle. Several blocks away, when the SUV eased up to a stop sign, Daniel stabbed the brake pedal. The Prius skidded on the leaves and tapped the bumper of the Jeep gently. He frowned and glanced forward. He saw the eyes of the Jeep's occupants, the drivers in the mirror, and his college-aged passengers directly. The girl turned to gaze with some generic hostility. Daniel winced and climbed out. He joined the driver standing by the Jeep's open door. He shook his head.
I am so sorry.
The stocky man in a navy sport coat, tan slacks, and blue shirt grinned ruefully.
Not like you were doing 100 miles an hour. I didn't think the leaves would be that slick. Man, it was like ice. I just kept going.
Daniel looked into the front seat. He said to the girl, clearly the man's daughter,
Sorry, you okay?
Like, yeah, I guess.
The blonde girl returned to her iPod. The day was warm, but she wore a stocking cap pulled down tight over her long hair, and the sleeves of her thick sweatshirt extended nearly to her fingers. The two men walked to the back of the SUV and regarded the vehicle. The Cherokee driver said,
They make 'em tough. I was going to say American cars, but hell, I don't really know where these babies are built. Could be Tokyo.
A nod at the Prius.
And that could have been made in Arkansas. Parts of it, anyway.
Daniel looked around the immaculate neighborhood. All was still deserted.
Thomas, listen carefully. Are you listening?
The driver kept grinning, waiting for an explanation. When there was none, he asked,
Do I know you?
No, you don't. Now I want the name of the bank in Aruba your investment partnership uses, and the main investment account number and the PIN.
Wait, what is this?
Daniel unbuttoned his jacket and displayed the narrow grip of an old Smith & Wesson revolver, a .38 special.
Oh my God!
His eyes went to his daughter, lost in the elixir of music.
Just give me the information and you'll be fine. She will too.
Who are you?
His voice rose into a filament of sound, not unlike a note from a reed instrument.
Hold on. Hold on,
Daniel said, keeping a smile on his face just in case anybody did happen to be behind one of those black windows.
Don't panic. You don't want to do that. This is just business. All I want is that information. I'll verify it and then you go on your way. You'll be out $20 million, but no one will get hurt. Besides, you didn't exactly get that through socially minded investments, did you?
You're insane,
he whispered. Panic was gone. Anger had taken its place. And fast.
You do this in front of my daughter? Who are you working for?
Thomas, you don't have much time. I'll shoot your daughter first because I need you alive to give me...
All right, don't even mention that. Don't even say it. All right, I'll give it to you.
Daniel placed a call.
Hello?
Came the low, melodious answering voice.
Andrew.
He handed the phone to Thomas and instructed,
Give him the information.
I don't have it memorized.
She gets shot first and...
I just mean it's in my phone. It's encrypted. It'll take a minute.
Daniel said into the phone,
He's got to decrypt it.
Andrew Faraday said through the tinny speaker,
Okay, but hurry.
Daniel glanced into the Jeep. The girl seemed irritated that she couldn't find a song on her playlist. With Daniel watching to make sure that Thomas didn't hit 911, the businessman began typing on his mobile. He lost his place. He took a deep breath. Daniel told him,
Stay calm. Take your time.
He said hurry.
Calm,
Daniel said. Thomas started over. He nodded at the screen and took the phone from Daniel's hand. He began reciting numbers. Daniel took back the iPhone.
Well?
He asked Andrew. He heard keyboard taps. A delay.
It's good.
The phone disconnected. The whole incident from car tap to confirmation had taken 4 minutes. Just the time for two drivers to good-naturedly swap insurance info and agree there'd be no point in calling the police.
Now get in your car and drive home. It's okay. You gave us what we wanted. It's all over with now. Just go home.
Thomas turned and reached for the Jeep's door with shaking hands. When he'd opened it, Daniel took a paper towel from his pocket and, wrapping it around the grip of the gun, drew the weapon and shot the businessman twice in the back of the head. He leaned down and looked in the passenger compartment, where blood flecked the dashboard and the windshield and the face and hat of his daughter, who was screaming as she stared at her father's twitching body. She was clawing frantically at the door handle. Daniel held up a reassuring hand. She froze, uncertain about the gesture he imagined, and turned slightly toward him. He shot her once in the center of the chest. As she slumped back, staring up, he shot her twice more, in the mouth, for the brainstem. This emptied the 5-round cylinder. Daniel dropped the gun on the seat and pocketed the paper towel. He returned to the Prius and pulled around the Cherokee slowly. He drove out of the neighborhood, occasionally checking the rearview mirror, but saw no lights, no emergency vehicles. He noted only a few SUVs, two coincidentally with nearly identical infant seats affixed in the back seat. He took a direct route to the parkway and then headed into the city. Eventually, he ended up in the South Bronx. GPS sent him to an intersection near one of the better, or at least cleaner, housing projects. He drove to where a Taurus sat idling in a parking space. He eased up behind it and flashed his lights, though the driver had already seen him, he'd observed. When the Ford had pulled out of the space, Daniel parallel parked, wiped the interior for fingerprints, then climbed out and dropped the keys on the floor of the car, leaving it unlocked. He got into the Taurus's passenger seat. Daniel nodded to bald, fit Sam Easton behind the wheel, and Sam lifted his foot off the brake and sped down the street.
Heard it went good. Andrew called.
Fine.
And no tail, Daniel said. I'm 99% sure.
Sam nodded, though, as Daniel would have done. He continued to check the rearview mirror more frequently than a prudent driver might. Before the Ford turned onto the street that would take them into Manhattan, Daniel glanced back and noted two young men slow as they walked past the Prius, looking around, then easing closer, like coyotes sniffing out wounded prey. Daniel read a text. The cash had been drained from the Aruba account and was already laundered.
You want to go home?
Sam asked.
Or drop you at the usual place? Downtown. The club.
Daniel invariably spent Friday afternoons swimming at his health club in Battery Park. Then would have a drink or two at Limoncello's and take his boat out for a sunset ride in New York Harbor. After that, some Indian or Thai food and back home, where he'd summon one of the girls from the outcall service he used. Whom to pick, he wondered. Daniel was in a particular mood after the shooting. He found himself picturing the outstretched, bloody body of the target's daughter. This memory was persistent and alluring. He decided he'd ask for one of the girls who allowed her customers to practice rough trade. Still, he reminded himself that he'd have to exercise a bit more restraint than several weeks ago, when Alice, or was it Alina, ended up in the emergency room. Chapter 3. 12:20 p.m. Friday. 1 hour, 10 minutes earlier.
Gabby!
She turned to see the pudgy red-headed man approaching through the aisles of the electronics superstore near City Hall. She thought again of her initial impression from a month or so ago when they'd met. The round 30-something had farm boy written all over him, a look you didn't see much in Manhattan. Not that there was anything wrong with this image intrinsically. Anything but the hipster look, Gabriella felt. The problem was just that it was too easy to picture him in overalls. She smiled.
Hi. What are you doing here? Frank Walsh asked her, smiling.
He wore a tan polo shirt, which matched everybody else's here. His name tag reported, F. Walsh, Computer Fix-It Department Manager. She took his hand, which he turned into a hug. Gabriella said, Have a meeting downtown. Thought I'd say hi.
His face seemed to glow.
No kidding. I was just thinking about you. Wow, Tiffany's.
She glanced down at the bag. Just my comfy shoes.
I like the ones you're wearing,
he whispered, noting the spiky high heels, which elevated her to his height. Stuart Weitzman's. They cost the same as one of the computers on sale at a nearby end cap.
Try walking to work in them sometime, she said with a laugh.
On the far wall, scores of the same Geico commercial flickered from TV screens large and small. Frank glanced at his watch.
You free for lunch?
No, I have to get back to that meeting. Got time for coffee, though.
Deal.
They went to a Starbucks next door, collected their drinks, she a black coffee, Frank a frothy latte. They sat and chatted amid the muted grind of blenders and the hiss of the steam device. Despite appearances, Frank was about as far removed from the farm as could be.
Nerd was a better descriptive, a word that she would have avoided, but he'd said it about himself once or twice, so maybe it was politically correct.
Computers consumed him. His job here, of course. And he seemed to be an avid participant in online role-playing games. She deduced this from the way he had coyly asked her if she knew certain titles. She'd never played one in her life. Then, looking a bit disappointed, he'd changed the subject and didn't bring the topic up again, probably embarrassed. Frank Walsh was a film buff, too. He went to the movies twice a week. This they had in common. They sipped coffee and chatted. Then he confided with a grimace.
I've got the weekend off, but I've got to visit my mother.
Congratulations, and all my sympathies. He laughed. She's on Long Island? Gabriella recalled. Syosset. But I'm back about noon Sunday. There's a noir festival at the Soho that starts then. You interested? Sterling Hayden, Ida Lupino, Dan Duryea, the best of the best. Oh, sorry, Frank. Have plans Sunday.
Sure.
He didn't seem particularly disappointed.
Hey, I'm making a mixtape with those songs you liked. Well, mix download. Mention tape to a new clerk here and they're like, huh?
Wow, thanks, Frank. Though she wondered, which songs were those? She didn't listen to much modern music. No pop at all. A lot of classical and jazz. Many old-time crooners and cabaret singers. Sinatra, Count Basie, Nat King Cole, Rosemary Clooney, Denise Darcel. She'd inherited a massive collection of marvelous albums. Hundreds of them, embraced by their beautiful, rich-smelling cardboard jackets. She'd bought a Michel Gyrodeck turntable a few years ago, a beautiful machine. When she cranked up the volume in her apartment, the sounds it sent to the amplifier were completely pure, arresting. They stole your soul. She may have mentioned this to Frank in passing, and he'd remembered. Conversation meandered, to De Niro's latest film, to Frank's mother's health, to Gabriella's plans to redecorate her Upper West Side apartment. Then,
funny you show up today,
uttered in a certain tone.
How's that?
I was going to call you later, but here you are.
So?
Gabriella sipped the strong coffee. She lifted an eyebrow toward him pleasantly, meaning, go on.
Ask you something?
You bet.
Any chance of us?
He swallowed from nerves.
Us?
Gabriella wondered if that pronoun was the end of the sentence, though she suspected it was. Frank filled in anyway.
Dating, more seriously. Oh, hey, I'm not talking about marriage. God, I don't even think that makes financial sense nowadays. But every time we've been out, it's clicked. I know it's only a few times, but still.
He took a breath and plunged forward.
Look, I'm not a Ryan Gosling, but I'm working at losing a few pounds. I really am.
He looked down into his coffee. He'd made a show of using equal, not sugar, and ordered with 2% milk, though Gabriella knew those were not the tools for fighting weight. She told him,
women like men for a lot of reasons, not just their looks.
And I went out with somebody who was a dead ringer for Ryan Gosling once, and he was a complete dick.
Yeah?
Hey, I like you, Frank. I really do. And there could be an us. I just want to take things real slow. I've had some problems in the past. You have too, right?
Hey, I've been a mistake magnet.
He elaborated on what he'd told her a few weeks ago about a difficult breakup. She couldn't quite tell who was the dumpee and who the dumper. As she listened, she counted 16 freckles on his face.
I respect that, he said seriously.
What? Had she missed something?
That you're being reasonable, taking time, thinking about things. And that you didn't get all weird and run out of here.
How can I run? I'm wearing killer high heels.
Which are pretty nice.
And now that Frank had raised a serious topic and the matter had been debated, he dropped it, for which she was infinitely grateful. He rose, pulled 3 sugar packets out of the tray and returned, spilling the contents into his coffee, then stirring up a whirlpool. Before he sat, though, he whipped his Samsung phone out of its holster.
Smile.
What? He aimed the camera lens at her and shot a few pictures, full length from head to shoe, as she grinned. Finally, he sat, reviewed the pictures.
Some keepers.
Frank then sipped more coffee and looked up at her.
You know, that film festival's going on all week.
Really? I'm free Tuesday, if you like.
I'm working then.
Well, nah, if Tuesday works for you, I'll swap shifts.
Really?
For you?
Yeah.
That's really sweet, Frank. Really sweet. She gave him a breezy smile. Chapter 2. 11 a.m. Friday. 1 hour, 20 minutes earlier. Brad Kepler and Naresh Sarani waited in an NYPD conference room that featured a single speckled window, which overlooked a building that, Kepler believed, overlooked New York Harbor. This was as good as most views got, at least for Detectives Third, in one police plaza. At least when they were involved in an operation that had no name, that nobody knew about, and that therefore could presumably break a career as much as make one. Kepler admired his arm, less muscular than when he'd joined the force, but more robustly tanned. He then regarded Sarani, who had a nearly gray complexion, which stayed gray no matter how much sun he got. Both men were more or less mid-30s and more or less fit, though Kepler's physique reflected the reality of life as a detective, sedentary, with walking the most strenuous exercise on the job. He'd chased somebody a month ago and caught him, but his hip still hurt.
This guy the shit he seems to be?
He tapped a file on the table in front of him.
Dunno, Sarani answered his partner. Never heard of him. What's this room for? I didn't know it was even here.
The office near their division, Major Cases, was scuffed and dim and populated with a lopsided table, 6 chairs, 3 of them unmatched, a filing cabinet, and dozens of boxes labeled discard. And the totally useless view. But at least it was a view, unlike his cubicle, 5 or 6 or 1,000 floors away, where the only thing he could feast his eyes on was the butt of Detective Lakeisha Town, which was a lot to see. And that image appealed not in the least. Kepler now regarded the boxes and decided it was amusing, the labels. The boxes looked like they'd been here for months. So why hadn't somebody just discarded them, per instructions? Welcome to the NYPD. The time was just after 11 a.m. You could smell old oil, garlic, fish, like you could in much of the building from time to time, depending on prevailing winds and humidity, given the proximity and the relentless encroachment of Chinatown. As for Little Italy, arrivederci.
I'm hungry,
Kepler said.
I am too, but
where is everybody?
Sarani didn't know. So they took phone calls. They made phone calls.
Because,
said Kepler on his galaxy, explaining to a perp he'd busted, now out on bond,
they wouldn't knock it down any farther. It's the best they'll do, which means it's the best you can do. 18 months, you can serve that standing on your head. Shit, man,
came Devon's voice from the other end of the line.
Okay, gotta go.
Kepler disconnected, snuck a look at his warm brown arm once more. He didn't tell anybody its source was the lamps of the Larchmont Tanning Salon, 15 miles from home. He told people he jogged every day. He played golf. He swam.
That was Devon? Sarani asked.
Yeah.
18 months? Standing on his head? No way. He's screwed.
I know that. You know that. Devon will know it. Too bad, but he shouldn't have drove the getaway car.
Which it wasn't, Sarani said.
What? The car. Nobody got away.
Kepler gave a laugh.
Captain's late. They're both late. And I'm hungry. You ruled at trial yesterday.
Sarani said with some modesty.
Yeah, that went good. I was happy.
Good jury.
I like good juries.
The two detectives bickered more than they complimented each other and were sometimes downright insulting. But all forms of repartee were based on a similar affection. Infuriating was a word that often arose. He and Sarani had been lovers for the past 7 years and partners in the professional sense for 4. Someday soon, one or the other would propose marriage. Kepler was pretty close to popping the question. And God save anybody on the force who made a single comment about it, lifted a single eyebrow, exhaled a single sigh. Kepler examined his phone again to order takeaway. At the beginning of his address book on the galaxy were 3 folders, !! breakfast, !! dinner, !! lunch, the punctuation mark added so the files would stay first in line before people. He was debating between the first and third. He was sort of in a pancake mood when the brass finally cruised into the room. The promise of sausages and waffles went away, along with the phone itself, when the harried man in a suit strode inside. Wrinkled of face, boasting multiple chins, Captain Paul Barclay was in his late 50s. He carried the round belly of somebody who ate when it was convenient for him, not when the long hours and necessities of a case required him to grab breakfast to go when it was really lunchtime, or vice versa. Still, the man had a rep as righteous as Kepler's tan, and far more genuine. Everybody knew Barclay had paid his dues, and he carried bullet scars to prove it, according to legend. So none of the detectives griped, at least not too much, and definitely not to his face.
Gentlemen?
Captain, Sarani said. A nod from Kepler.
Busy day,
Barclay muttered, and looked at his iPhone to prove it. Read a text. Sent a text, ignoring the men. Kepler's stomach protested.
Waffles. He wanted waffles. Or maybe a club sandwich.
Barclay snapped.
So, what's this about? Request for an undercover op.
Right,
Kepler said.
Where's Detective McNamara?
On the way,
Kepler said.
Well, get started.
Barclay raised an intimidating eyebrow. Impatience ruled.
Well, you know, sir, we're not sure. We didn't put it together.
It was... Sarani stopped speaking and looked behind the captain into the doorway. Here's the mastermind of the op. She can give you all the details. Hey, Gabby. The beautiful but severe woman stepped into the room. Unsmiling, typically, she looked over all 3 men, nodding a greeting to the captain. Kepler, with his proclivities, wasn't the least interested in Detective Gabby for her body. But man, she dressed well. He appreciated that. A thin white blouse beneath the black and white checked jacket. What was that cloth called again? There was some word for it, that pattern. A gray skirt. And those were great dark stockings. Nice high heels, too. He and Sarani weren't into cross-dressing, but if they had been, there were worse people to mimic than Detective Gabby. She was a bit of a legend herself. Daughter of a detective working organized crime, she'd joined the force right out of college, working crime scene. When her father was killed in the line of duty, she became a detective and moved up to major cases, often working OC detail like her old man had, specializing in the ultra-violent Eastern European gangs based in Brooklyn and Queens. Known for her undercover work, she had a shining arrest record. And, more important, her conviction rate was off the charts. Anybody could collar anybody. Having the brains and balls to make sure they went away for a long period of time was something else altogether.
Gabby pushed an ornery strand of auburn hair off her forehead. The captain asked her,
"So you want to run an undercover op?"
"Sounds like a TV show,"
Kepler quipped, trying to get her to smile. Everyone ignored him, and he decided to stop being cute.
"That's right," she told them.
"What's the deal?"
"I heard from a CI of mine there's a player who's surfaced. Guy named Daniel Reardon."
"Never heard of him. Organized crime?"
"No connection with any of the crews I could find," Gabby reported. "According to my informant, he runs a small operation out of a Wall Street front. He's got two partners he works with, have first names only. Andy or Andrew, and Sam."
"Or Samuel?"
Kepler inquired.
She turned her eyes on him. Usually they were green. Today they were more yellowish,
eerie.
"Only Sam,"
spoken briskly, as if, "Wouldn't I have mentioned the longer name if that was what I'd heard?
Don't know anything else about them, but my CI heard it's an 8-figure operation."
"Jesus, who's your informant?"
"Guy connected with the Sedotto crew."
With some reverence, Kepler asked,
"Your guy's a confidential informant embedded with Sedotto? And he's still alive?"
As if irritated at the interruption, she said curtly, "He's very good, and I pay him a lot of money to be good."
The captain asked,
"What are Reardon and his crew into?"
"It's serious shit, Paul. Mostly cleaning money, some drugs, some guns, offshore stuff. But the worst is he's hit at least a half dozen people, a couple witnesses and some rivals. And one of the witnesses, apparently the guy's family was with him. Killed them too."
"Oh, man,"
Sarani said, shaking his head. He and Kepler were exploring adopting.
"Multi-million operation and hits,"
the captain mused. He did not sound at all dismayed. Good press material, he'd be thinking. This was cynical, but Kepler knew you had to consider image in this business. White knight shit mattered at budget time. It mattered at promotion time. This was a game everybody learned and nobody felt guilty about playing.
"What do you have in mind for the set?"
Barclay asked. "It's going to be tricky. Reardon's smart, and suspicious as hell, according to my CI. I need to set up a fake office somewhere in Manhattan."
"Office? What does that mean?"
Barclay asked bluntly. Her voice matched his. "A company, a business, an office. Probably an investment firm. I don't need much. A couple of rooms, furniture, some phony files I'll gin up myself. Decorations, props. The office will be deserted and half empty like it was raided. That's part of my plan."
"We're not Abscam. We don't have a lot of money."
"What's Abscam?" Sarani asked. No one answered. Kepler reminded himself to explain to his partner that it was one of the biggest stings in U.S. history. Gabby said,
"Won't cost us much. I was thinking we could use that place narcotics closed up last month. It's just sitting empty, Midtown, Turtle Bay. Oh, and I'll need an unoccupied townhouse somewhere on the Upper East Side."